I am.
Good. Okay, you're presenting on translating research into practice, the physician's perspective. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm going to be presenting a portion of my dissertation that I defended earlier this year. And what I looked at is how physicians translate research into practice. I was in a public administration and policy program, and I thought it was important that we got the perspective of physicians, because many policy decisions are made, but they're made without regard for those people in the trenches and the impact that they have upon them. I also looked at how physicians translate research into practice. What was the utilization of electronic medical record, which I think is a vehicle for translating research into practice, and also their perceptions of pay for performance, which is being purported as a way to also translate research into practice. I'm only going to be presenting the first part, physician perceptions of how they translate research into practice. I have no relationships to disclose. And I chose this topic because it relates to quality health care. And I had been a nurse practitioner in clinical practice for many years. And I think quality health care and how to achieve it is really very important but very challenging. I like this definition from the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. And it defines quality health care as doing the right thing at the right time, in the right way, for the right person every time. In essence, we're talking about hitting a Grand Slam home run every time. Think about how hard that is to do. So what's the evidence to demonstrate that we don't have quality health care in this country? Well, the first is that in 1999, the Institute of Medicine released their scathing report entitled To Err is Human, in which they documented that there are 98,000 hospital deaths a year from medical errors. And many people feel this is an underestimate. Since that time, other research has shown that medical errors are associated with 7 out of every hospital admissions. In 2001, the Institute took that even further and wrote about crossing the quality chasm and said that there is definitely a huge gap between the quality of health care that patients do receive and the quality that they should receive. Studies have shown that Americans receive half of the recommended care that they should, and this includes preventive care, that 30 to 45% of patients do receive health care that is not evidence-based, and that a quarter of the health care is unnecessary or has a propensity to cause harm. And I think evidence to support this was what happened with the drug Vioxx that had been on the market for 5 years before other research showed that there was a 4-fold increase in cardiovascular events in patients on Vioxx. Yet when researchers went back and looked at the original research, those findings were there. From the economic perspective, Davis and colleagues found that clearly value does not equate with expenditures. Compared across all nations, we spend the most on healthcare, but we do not have the best outcomes. So what is the translational research gap? In 1990, Coyle and Socop defined it as the 17-year gap between when new research is discovered and when it's widely disseminated into practice. And when you think about it, that's a huge period of time during which we are missing opportunities for treating patients. Patients are denied treatments that have been shown to have proven benefit, and that there's certainly a costly overuse, underuse, and misuse of services. Don Berwick from Harvard equates that the greatest challenge is in the underuse of healthcare services. We have known for 20 years that beta blockers and aspirin reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease in patients that have known atherosclerosis, and more recently that statins are utilized in patients that have had strokes. The quality of the medical evidence is also a major barrier to the research, translational research gap. There's limited quantity and quality of evidence for many decisions. Many decisions that physicians and nurse practitioners make are not evidence-based. The flip side of that is Lisa Simpson points out that evidence alone rarely leads to improvements in practice or changes in policy. And I found that too. Just because there's a good study, it doesn't mean that physicians are going to adopt those results quickly. And also medical decision making, I think, from Loomis and his many years of research have really shown that medical decision making is very complex, and it's not clearly a linear process whereby physicians become aware of a new study, they adopt it, and then it gets translated into practice. And our current healthcare structure is really in a state of disarray, dysfunction, and obviously that precludes more effective translational research into practice. When you look at quality improvement projects, they're often reactive. Insurers look at the number of colonoscopies were done, the number of mammograms. What we really need is a system that's set up to drive decision-making down to the point of service. So three questions that I looked at were: what factors influence the uptake of new research by individual physicians? To what extent do most insurance companies reimburse physicians when they do adhere to evidence-based guidelines? And are there specific areas where insurance companies are less likely to reimburse physicians when they do adhere? This was a qualitative study, and because the field of translational research is relatively new, it certainly lent itself to a descriptive study. I used a model from the National Center for the Dissemination of Disability Research that looked at four variables: the source of the information, where did it come from, the content, what was included in the information, the medium, how it was delivered, and then individual idiosyncrasies related to the user, and how did each of these influence knowledge utilization. I also added a fifth variable, and that was: how do physicians respond to new results that come out that conflict with current standards of practice? Because that's something that they definitely confront pretty regularly, and it's often hard to ferret out. The first phase of the study was qualitative. I interviewed physicians, and I chose three subspecialties: internal medicine, because internists need to have a very broad knowledge base, and then I chose cardiologists and oncologists, because their knowledge base may be more in-depth but more limited, and I thought that there might be differences in how each of these groups translate research into practice, and in fact, that was true. And these were primarily open-ended questions. Then from the analysis of the qualitative phase, I developed a survey that was sent to 3,000 physicians in the same three specialties in New York State, and that was a six-response survey. Some of the key findings that I wanted to present are: one, physicians still regard print journals as the primary source from which they glean new information, and this really blew me away. I really expected it to be more electronic journals. But there were two reasons why they said that. One was the portability, that physicians are so busy seeing patients during the day that they really have limited time to look at new research. So they often would take a journal to their child's baseball game or football game or something like that, and that's when they would read about new research. The other was that even though you can find almost anything online using a search engine, that didn't necessarily mean that the evidence was of good quality that way. So some of the physicians felt waiting until it was in a peer-reviewed journal certainly created some increased academic rigor. Drug refs, as you can see, were very low on the list. Cardiologists and oncologists looked to their specialty organization websites like the American College of Cardiology. But unfortunately, internists don't have that single venue. So I think that also presents a serious barrier. In regard to content, certainly the quality and the validity of the study findings, the internal and external validity, were most important to physicians in determining whether they would take up the research, followed by the strength of the medical evidence. In regard to the medium, this varied by specialty and how long physicians had been in practice. About a third of the physicians, especially those who were older or in small practices, were really reluctant to use health information technology as compared to the cardiologists and oncologists. And this sort of makes sense because I think the cardiologists and oncologists are used to using technology for various procedures, so they're more likely to embrace it. In regard to the individual users, the greatest influence on adoption of new findings was the credibility of the evidence. If a study was well-designed, the physicians felt it had strong statistical power to reach the conclusions it did, they were more likely to take up the evidence. The second greatest influence was the ease of which the information was disseminated. If it was disseminated in a format that physicians really didn't understand very well, they were certainly less likely to take it up. And then expense was included, although that was third. The oncologist, I felt, really understood the translational research gap the most. They were very frustrated with studies that are done on something that we already know or that may show a 2 or a 5% improvement over what is currently done in practice at the expense of answering questions that we really don't know the answer to that they confront in practice every day. So clearly there was a potential gap between insurance reimbursement and physicians' awareness, physicians' adherence to guidelines. And this was evidenced by a physician who had received guidelines from the New York State Health Department around asthma. And the guidelines that the health department had released had been put together by many, many stakeholders within New York State that have a vested interest in asthma and outcomes. And one of the recommendations in the guidelines was that patients with asthma should have a spirometry every 1 to 2 years. Yet when physicians would do that in practice, they weren't necessarily reimbursed by their insurer, and as a result, stopped doing that. So I think that represents a serious concern about if evidence-based guidelines are being promoted, reimbursement certainly needs to be linked to it. In regard to the quantitative findings, the mean age was 53.3, 80% of respondents were males, and 57.3% were internists, 27.3% cardiologists, and 13.3% were oncologists. In regard to the rate of adoption of new research findings, overall, 58.7% of physicians felt they were early adopters, so they would adopt the results of a study within 2 years of its publication. None of the physicians felt they were late adopters, which was defined as 5 years or more. In regard to the early adopters, 70% of the oncologists fell in that category, followed by 64.5% of the cardiologists. And this sort of makes sense because, you know, patients in these specialties are often critical. So when new studies come out, I think these subspecialists are more likely to adopt the findings. However, it's interesting because only 54.7% of internists felt that they were early adopters, and the majority of patients in this country receive their primary health care through internists. In regard to understanding research study design, 46.9% of the physicians felt they were very strong and 44.3% felt they were average. Across the specialties, again, cardiologists and oncologists rated their understanding as very strong or strong in comparison to the internists who felt it was more average. And this may be a reflection of the additional training in fellowships that cardiologists and oncologists receive. However, when they were asked about their understanding of methods of statistical analysis, the results were very different, and only 22.2% of physicians felt they were very strong. Over half felt they were average. And again, across the specialties, internists regarded their understanding as average. And I think this may relate to their training. Many physicians said that they had not had any statistical course or EPI within 5 or more years. So I think there's a gap in helping to translate new research into practice related to that as well. When new research conflicts with current standards of practice, generally physicians would discuss the conflicting results with their colleagues. In other words, the study would pique their interest, but they would hold off on implementing the results. They would also turn to specialty organizations if they were a cardiologist or oncologist. These two subspecialties also felt that the MD-PhD epidemiologists that are often on the American College of Cardiology were very instrumental in deciphering the literature and helping to translate the research into practice, and that that made it a lot easier for the physicians in the field. Again, the internists don't have that luxury. Physicians also would oftentimes either look for additional studies to support the conflict on one way or the other, or wait for additional research to clarify the controversy.
You have about 2 minutes left.
Okay. In regard to the frequency of insurance reimbursement, more than 75% of the time, physicians felt that they were not reimbursed by insurers when they adhered to guidelines. And this was especially true amongst the cardiology group. The disease categories for which physicians were least likely to be reimbursed were preventive medicine and psychiatry. And think of how many patients in this country are seen in primary care and even specialty practices wanting preventive care and psychiatry. The implications for theory, while I think that the 17-year time frame is what's still being reported in the literature, I suspect that it is actually less than that because this study was done pre-internet and technology age. However, there still is a significant gap. In regard to challenges to the translational research, the strength and quality of the medical evidence is crucial, but yet all studies that are not always done through vigorous academic research criteria. There's also a statistical significance versus a clinical significance relevance. Many studies have statistical significance that's of interest to researchers, but it's the clinical relevance that people in the field really want. Health policy, billions of dollars are spent on basic research. much less is spent on how to translate research into practice, and reimbursement is not well aligned with patient services. Policy medical decision making is really a more complex process that I think certainly warrants further research. And we need to direct research more towards answering unanswered clinical questions rather than just replicating research. In closing, just because we have evidence about what should be done does not mean that we know how to change practice or policy. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Dr. Mata?
Yes.
This is evaluation of risk factors of Clostridium difficile associated with diarrhea in medicine and surgical inpatients.
Yes.